Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 501, titled Norbert Schley and the Strange Case of the 57s. This is being recorded on March 6th of the year 2005. What this program is going to be illustrating is how the, quote, system, unquote, works. It's a term that I don't particularly like. It smacks of, 60s radicalism, and it rubs me the wrong way. Nonetheless, though, there is a system, and it works in an inexorable fashion. And I guess the rule of that fashion, the fashion in which it works, could be called the golden rule. He who has gold rules. Specifically, what we're going to be looking at in this broadcast is the way in which financial relationships and big money completely supersede and overrule law, even very significant laws. And we're going to take a look at some innocent people being destroyed, absolutely destroyed, precisely in order to maintain the integrity of some sub rosa and altogether illegal but nonetheless pivotally powerful economic relationships. This type of paradigm is at work throughout the world. It has been for a long time. It's one of the things that governs the investigation into September 11th, basically, despite the fact that one of the major participants in the September 11th machinations were the Saudis. The fact that Saudi Arabia not only is an oil producer, but its profound economic relationship with the United States, including ownership of a great deal of American property, that, in the end, has superseded the rule of law. This is not an unusual thing. It shouldn't be happening, but in fact, it does. Now, here's what we're going to be looking at in this broadcast. We're going to start with a reading of a portion of the obituary for Norbert A. Schley, that's spelled S-C-H-L-E-I, who was a prominent civil rights lawyer in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. When he eventually went into private practice, some of his Asian clients came to him with some certificates of redemption known as 57s. These were Japanese government bonds, and they specifically had been issued by Prime Minister Tanaka Kakue in order to basically enable Mr. Tanaka to retain control over what was known as the M Fund. That was named for Mr. Marquardt, or General Marquardt, part of the occupation staff of General Douglas MacArthur. The M Fund was something we took a look at in a very big way in For the Record programs 428 and also 446, particularly 446. This fund consisted of loot, illegal loot that had been confiscated from occupied territories by the Japanese in World War II, but like a great deal of the rest of their wealth, it was used instead of being returned to its rightful owners, or instead of the rightful owners being compensated, it was instead retained under the control initially of the U.S., then of Japan, and it was used for the purposes of basically buying political privilege in post-war Japan, specifically Japanese politicians, many of them war criminals, who were very, very far to the right and anti-communist and thus deemed to be important figures for the looming Cold War, they were financed. Their political successes were financed by the M Fund. Eventually, Richard Nixon turned control of the M Fund over to the Japanese in exchange for some kickbacks to try to get him elected in 1960. And the M Funds ultimately proved to be a tremendously lucrative and corrupting element in Japanese politics, and as we will see, American politics and American jurisprudence as well. After taking a look at Norbert Schley's obituary, we're going to examine the history of the 57s. Basically, the 57s were specially issued Japanese government certificates that were issued specifically for the purposes of enabling only certain privileged people to redeem them. This was a way of maintaining the solvency of the M Fund, which was already overdrawn. Basically, the exposure of the M Fund was protected through the issuance of these very special bonds. The 57 refers to the 57th year of Emperor Hirohito's reign. After taking a look at the genesis of the 57s, we're going to take a look at what happened, first of all, to a woman named Barbara Jean Bravender Ah Lu, and then later, Norbert Schley. both of these people. One, a woman who had married a Chinese Hawaiian American, and Norbert Schley, who had gone into private practice. Both were destroyed as a result of their altogether legitimate attempts at redeeming 57s, because these 57s were only redeemable to the in crowd, so to speak. Because a message was to be sent by the American authorities to anybody attempting to redeem 57s who was not deemed to be part of the in crowd. First of all, Ms. A. Lu was completely destroyed in a very chilling fashion. And then Norbert Schley, a great and good man and a person who had done a lot of wonderful work on behalf of a great many Americans working for the Kennedy and Johnson administration, he was annihilated as well. What's worth noting is that the rule of law was totally, absolutely perverted in order to maintain the sanctity of the U.S.-Japanese post-war and Cold War relationship as embodied in the double-edged 57s. These 57s were very lucrative if you were part of the in crowd, but if you weren't and you tried to redeem them, you wish you'd never been born. After looking at how Ms. Alu and the late Norbert Schley were destroyed for attempting to redeem 57s, we're going to take a look at the successful attempt by Alexander Haig at redeeming some 57s on behalf of the Paraguayan government. And the go-ahead, the okay, the letter of recommendation given to Alexander Haig in order to facilitate, sort of grease the wheels, so to speak, for his successful attempt at redeeming 57s on behalf of the Paraguayan government, that was provided by then-President George H.W. Bush. So this is a classic case of it doesn't matter what you know, but it's who you know that counts. That's what we're going to be examining, and here goes. We're going to begin by taking a look at the obituary of Norbert Schley. This is from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, April 21st of 2003. Story by Myrna Oliver. It headlined, Norbert Schley, principal author of Civil Rights Act and Other Landmark Laws. Norbert A. Schley, key lawyer in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations who found legal underpinning for the 1962 blockade of Cuba, wrote landmark civil rights legislation and once waged a strong bid to replace an entrenched Republican's California Secretary of State, has died, skipping down. Schley, a personable Democratic campaigner, was only yards from Robert Kennedy at Los Angeles' Ambassador Hotel when Kennedy was fatally shot on the night of the California primary in 1968. He largely bowed out of politics after serving as a delegate to the Democratic National Convention that year in Chicago. Skipping down. Joan Schley said Saturday that Schley had been completely exonerated after federal prosecutors conceded that there was a possibility the instruments are valid, unquote, and that Schley had been wrongly prosecuted. Skipping down. At issue were the bonds the Japanese government claimed were counterfeit and created by a forger they imprisoned in 1983. Schley countered that the securities were legitimate, that they had been issued in 1983 by Japan's Minister of Finance, Michio Watanabe, at the request of former Prime Minister Kakue Tanaka after Tanaka left office in a bribery scandal. That, in a nutshell, is what happened to Norbert Schley, and although eventually he was exonerated, the trauma, in particular the impoverishment that he underwent as a result of his attempt at redeeming 57s on the part of some Asian clients, that ultimately weakened and destroyed him. We're going to turn now for our information both about the M Fund and the 57s and the frightening case of Barbara Jean Bravender Alu and Norbert Schley. We're going to turn to the book Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. That is subtitled America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. And of the M Fund, again, generated in the immediate post-war period from loot that was illegally confiscated by Japan from occupied countries and subsequently turned into a slush fund to ensure the primacy of right-wing Japanese politicians, of the way in which the 57s were issued in order to protect the exposure of the M Fund, we read as follows in Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. Rather than cover this exposure by dipping into the M Fund or into his own private Bank of Japan, unquote, Tanaka and his clever associates at the Ministry of Finance came up with an ingenious dodge. They would roll over the original Japanese government bonds by exchanging them for new financial instruments called certificates of redemption. These were not the ministry's usual bonds, but a form of debt instrument, or IOU, specially designed, printed, and issued by the Ministry of Finance in the 57th year of Hirohito's reign, so they often are called 57s to distinguish them from regular government bonds. We will use that label in this book. Bondholders who already were owed outstanding interest would be given specially designed and printed cashier's checks from the Daiichi Kangyo Bank, serving as the ministry's conduit for interest payments. Because many of the bondholders were considered politically untrustworthy, they were given no choice in the matter and simply were told by the ministry that the exchange of bonds for 57s and cashier's checks would take place. While this might seem unusual in Europe or America, intimidation has been developed to such a high art in Japan that to defy the exchange would mean social ostracism or even assisted suicide. Already, the M Fund appeared to have led to the death of Kishi's brother, Prime Minister Sato. Many Japanese believe Sato was poisoned in 1975 at the height of a contest with Tanaka for control of the M Fund. A number of others associated with Sato and M Fund financing of Fuji Steel also died mysteriously in the early 1970s. A major scandal over Sato's death was avoided when Tanaka paid Sato's widow 300 billion yen from the M Fund. In 1984, Harvey Fukuda, Kodama's publisher and business partner who knew where all the skeletons were hidden, died of heart failure, unquote, while in the hospital being dried out and treated for cirrhosis of the liver. He had expressed fear of being poisoned, and members of his family did not believe his death was from natural causes. In Japan, if you're afraid of being murdered, it's considered good advice to avoid hospitals where the job can be done unobtrusively. The next assisted suicide was Prime Minister Takashita's personal assistant, Aoki Ihe, who knew too much about the 57s. According to the Wall Street Journal, Aoki, quote, slashed his wrists, legs, and neck, and when that failed, hanged himself with a necktie from a curtain rod, unquote. Physically, the 57s were unlike anything previously issued by the government of Japan. They were not offered to the public at large, nor were they to be traded on the international bond market like normal government bonds, so only the holders actually saw them. The magic of this scheme is that by their very difference, it was possible for the Ministry of Finance later to declare all 57s to be forgeries. Only certain ones were then selectively and very secretly renegotiated at a discount. Those who paid for their original government bonds and then were forced to exchange them for 57s were thus swindled twice. Washington had backed Tokyo's assertion that the 57s are counterfeit, but as we will see, there is evidence both are lying. Because they were jointly involved in setting up the M Fund with Golden Lily war loot, they both have reason to deny its existence. And for more complete discussion about Operation Golden Lily and the systematic Japanese looting of occupied territories and the post-war significance of this loot, For the Record programs number 427, 428, 446, and 451 have a lot of information about that that will flesh out your understanding. Now, we're going to turn to the first of the victims of the 57 scam here in the United States. This is a woman named Barbara Jean Bravender Alu. And because she was a relatively small fish, so to speak, eventually they went after Norbert Schley. But again, note here how basically sub-rosa economic relationships take complete primacy over basically the rule of law and decency. Until Washington turned the full force of its ire on Schley in 1992, the target of the U.S. government sting was an elderly invalid named Barbara Jean Bravender Alu, living in Los Angeles on Social Security benefits of less than $1,000 a month. a U.S. citizen of Caucasian origin. She had married a Hawaiian-Chinese businessman named Ah Lu and spent long periods with him in Hong Kong running a company called Transfield Investments. In 1987, Transfield was approached by Japanese clients, including Takahashi, looking for help in redeeming their 57s. By the way, this refers to Takahashi Toshio, who eventually became a client of Norbert Schley's. And in Norbert Schley's attempt at getting the 57s redeemed on behalf of his client, basically that led to his professional destruction. That's who Takahashi is here. Continuing. Initial efforts by Transfield failed when the Bank of Japan took the position that all 57s were fraudulent. During this period, Mrs. Alu met Craig Ivester, a bounty hunter employed by Bancorp International as a finder of commodity transactions. They discussed the 57s, and Ivester sent a photocopy of one to Union Bank Suisse, which replied automatically that it was fraudulent without bothering to examine the original. Aging and seriously ill, Mrs. Ah Lu then returned by herself to Los Angeles and was living in a single room borrowed from a terminally ill friend in a house facing foreclosure when she again encountered the bounty hunter. At this point, Craig Ivester was making his living as a U.S. Customs Service informer looking for targets. Reminded of their previous discussions of the 57s in Hong Kong, Ivester decided to persuade Mrs. Ah Lu to offer some 57s for sale inside the United States, which he knew was illegal, earning him a finder's fee from the Customs Service. Sick as she was, Mrs. Ah Lu still had gumption. She told Ivester she would never negotiate a 57 in the United States. Ivester approached the Customs Service and offered to help entrap Mrs. Ah Lu by baiting her with the offer of a very large commission. According to Schley's investigators, the sting operation was mounted by U.S. Secret Service agent Jack Fox and Customs Service agents Michael Sankey and Michael Noonan, acting on the tip from Ivester. Their plan was to offer Mrs. Ah Lu a big commission to coax her into obtaining a 57 to sell in America, then to arrest her for intent or merely contemplating a crime. Because she was so reluctant, Fox got credentials showing he was a vice president of First National Bank of Chicago. Sankey would pretend to be a rich businessman. They rented a room in Reno that they wired and asked her to come for a meeting. If they could get her to cross a state line, it would be construed as a federal offense rather than a state offense. Mrs. Ah Lu could not come because she could not afford the airline ticket. The Secret Service sent her a free round-trip ticket, the first concrete step in their entrapment. When she got to Reno, Mrs. Ah Lu said she was sorry, but she could not obtain any 57s. Anyway, she said the Japanese government claimed they were fraudulent and, quote, people have gone to jail for selling these bonds, unquote. Fox, Sankey, and Noonan persisted, browbeating Mrs. Ah Lu until finally she said she would try again to get a 57, but only if they could arrange a proper and legitimate transaction through a leading American securities firm, a firm that would make sure all laws were observed so nobody got in trouble. Secret Service Agent Fox promised to bring Smith Barney into the deal. He faxed Mrs. Ah Lu a letter purporting to be from A. George Sachs, Executive Vice President and General Counsel of Smith Barney, offering to purchase 3 57s. For the sting to work, it had to happen in a jurisdiction where there was a Smith Barney office and a compliant judge. They decided to lure Mrs. Ah Lu to Tampa, Florida, where Smith Barney had an office, and where the U.S. attorney expected Federal District Court Judge Elizabeth Kovacevic to be cooperative, allowing him to go for the jugular. Eventually, Mrs. Ah Lu heard about Roger Hill, a broker who had some of Takahashi's 57s in his possession, hoping to find a potential buyer. But on the eve of the trip to Tampa, Mrs. Ah Lu suffered a heart attack and asked her son, Bruce Hansberry, to go with Roger Hill in her place to conclude the deal at Smith Barney. When they arrived in Tampa, on January 18, 1992, they were arrested. Because she was not present, They had to rope in Mrs. Alu by getting her on the telephone to discuss the fictitious closing so she could be arrested in Los Angeles. This was done, and she was taken into custody. On the pretext that her earlier residence in Hong Kong meant she might try to flee the country, she was put in prison to await trial, and ultimately was convicted of conspiracy, wire fraud, money laundering, and securities fraud. Bewildered, Mrs. Alu began to lose her mind and was moved to a prison psychiatric ward. There, she was found to have cancer of the throat and died. As if the deliberate entrapment of an impoverished and sick widow isn't scary enough, now we're going to see basically what's called escalation. We're going to take a look at these same forces making an example of Norbert Schley in order to maintain the viability of the 57s, which in turn was meant to protect the genesis of the M Fund and other funds stemming from the Black Eagle Trust, and that indeed was one of the ongoing secrets of World War II. Basically, like Germany, Japan won World War II economically, not militarily, but economically, and when you win economically, you win politically. More about that time permitting at the end of the broadcast. Now, of the escalation from the victimization of Mrs. Alu to the victimization of Norbert Schley, we read as follows. By January of 1992, 16 officers of the Secret Service were said to be involved in the Alu sting. Mrs. Alu was too insignificant to justify such an expenditure of taxpayers' money, so the vigilantes looked for someone else to lynch. One possibility was Takahashi Toshio, to whom the 57s belonged, but when they broke into his Los Angeles apartment, it was empty, and he was out of the country in hiding. Trophy hunting has become a feature of the American criminal justice system. Takahashi was not famous, so he was not a proper trophy for an ambitious U.S. attorney. Norbert Schley, on the other hand, was sticking his nose into deep black secrets and alarming Tokyo. His high profile made him a perfect target. 1 year earlier, Schley had written a memo about the M Fund. It was not meant for general circulation, but a copy was passed to U.S. government officials who became alarmed and angry. If they could snare Schley, all branches of the U.S. government would cooperate to stop his digging into the M Fund, and the LDP leadership in Tokyo would be indebted. How to snare him was the problem. Schley had never tried to negotiate a 57 in America, only in Japan on behalf of clients legally entitled to have an attorney make inquiries. Furthermore, Schley had never accepted a penny from these clients. But Takahashi was so impatient to sell one of his 57s that he had taken several of them back from Schley and, without telling him, turned them over to Roger Hill to market. It was quite a stretch to argue that Schley had anything to do with the independent marketing of the 57s by Roger Hill. The government could try to get Schley indicted as a party to the conspiracy of Alu, Hansberry, and Hill because he happened to be Takahashi's attorney and was admittedly trying to negotiate other 57s in Japan. It would be absurd to assert that Schley was involved in the Tampa transaction, but that could be covered by a little sleight of hand misdirecting the jury so it didn't notice. Finally, since Schley freely acknowledged that the Japanese government regarded the 57s as counterfeit, it could be argued that he was admittedly marketing certificates he knew to be false. This dodged the crucial point, which Schley stated again and again, that he was convinced the Japanese government was lying to avoid payment. In sum, the case against Schley would depend on a trophy-hunting prosecutor, a compliant judge, a misdirected jury, a coordinated effort by Washington to block all Schley's efforts at discovery, denial by the court of leave for Schley to take depositions in Japan, intimidation of defense witnesses, and, quote, expert, unquote, prosecution witnesses brought in from Japan's Ministry of Finance and Daiichi Bank, who seem to have been coached to be evasive and to give false testimony. Astonished to be named a party to the Alu deal, of which he was not even aware, Schley found himself the subject of grand jury proceedings in Tampa and was indicted. Immediately, clients holding 57 scattered to avoid being drawn in or, if cornered, became so frightened that they offered to testify against Schley in return for immunity from prosecution. In court, the prosecution, quote, proved, unquote, the certificates were fakes by bringing in two minor officials of Japan's Ministry of Finance and Dai-ichi Bank who had a vested interest in sticking to this story. Schley's defense countered, quote, corrupt Japanese officials were now falsely claiming that these financial instruments were not genuine. However, Professor Lossier insisted they were genuine, as quoted earlier. Quote, the documents are so precisely in agreement in innumerable respects with the official published records of the government of Japan that, in my opinion, it is quite impossible for them or the certificates that resulted from them to have been the work of any counterfeiter. Unquote. To demonstrate collusion between Tokyo and Washington, the defense attempted to locate any reports or documents showing covert payments by the U.S. government to the government of Japan or any political party in Japan from 1945 to the present. As we've seen, this has been confirmed by a number of sources, including former CIA officials and U.S. diplomats. But, fighting for his life, Schley needed all the documentary evidence available. As a former Assistant Attorney General of the United States, he was certain he would find these documents. It was Schley's right to make such discoveries, but federal agencies flatly refused to comply. News stories about the M Fund and 57s obliged the court to order the CIA, the Secret Service, National Archives, and State Department to conduct a search of their databases. Given the intense secrecy surrounding the Black Eagle Trust, the 1951 peace treaty, the M Fund, and the disappearance of millions of documents concerning Japan, it would have been a great surprise if anything turned up. The jury was told that, quote, search of the records of the CIA, the Secret Service, and the National Archives did not disclose any relevant or material documents or information that substantiated that the CIA gave money to employees or officials of the Japanese government or any political party in Japan. The court record says, quote, the government searched hundreds of files of CIA paper records dating back to 1948 for any documents that might indicate that payments were made by the CIA to either the Japanese government, the Liberal Democratic Party, or individual party members. They also conducted computer searches for Marquardt Fund, and the search did not discover any relevant or material documents or information, unquote. We'll continue with this discussion on the second side of this program. Before wrapping up this side, let me remind you of the CD Duplication Service Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word. You can reach them by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. That's capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D. Be sure to visit their website. First of all, the email address, I should say, is spitfirelist@hotmail.com. Visit their website at www.spitfirelist.com. There are long, annotated, article-length descriptions of the For the Record shows, usually up within a week or two of the airing of the broadcast. There are also links to various websites, including two websites maintained by sister station WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey. WFMU is archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio, and now much of it's available on MP3 as well. www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. This wraps up side one of For the Record program number 501, Norbert Schley and the Strange Case of the 57s, being recorded on March 6th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.